Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Politics and Tactics. Politics and Tactics, where education meets experience and expertise. Learn from the decision makers and talk one-on-one with elected leaders. Being a great firefighter is not enough. Politics affects our staffing, budget, and equipment. Get involved. And now, Frank Ricci, Anthony Avilo, and Chris Pepler.
Welcome to Politics and Tactics. Tonight we got a great show for you. I plan on doing more listening tonight than talking, but we have a phenomenal guest, and his name is David J., and I apologize if I mess up his name, Shostakis, and he wrote the book Constitutional Soundbites, America's Founding Documents and the First Principles in the 21st Century Presentation. I find his writing remarkable, and some of you may be listening tonight and saying, we're going to talk about the Constitution, but the fact is there's not a firefighter or police officer out there that doesn't take an oath from the day we join the fire service to defend the Constitution. So if we're going to take an oath to defend it, shouldn't we at least know what's in it? So I think it's vital that we understand the founding principles of our republic, and it doesn't have to be dry. And that's what Dave did. Yes, he's an attorney, but he's found a great way on Twitter to put out, besides his book, to put out stories that you can't even tell what side of the political spectrum Dave is on, and yet you learn every time you read one of his tweets or one of his stories, and I highly recommend his book. If you got a kid that's in high school or you want to really blow everybody's mind and do a drill on the Constitution, that would be funny. I really recommend the book Constitutional Soundbites. Dave, welcome to Politics and Tactics. We're honored to have you on the show. You're talking to firefighters throughout the entire United States and Canada, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk to us tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, for your kind invitation and your terrific introduction. I really, truly do appreciate that. I've been in law enforcement myself. I was state's attorney here in Cook County, Chicago, Illinois, for a number of years when I first, shortly after I first became a lawyer. And I of course, worked with both police and firefighters. So it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk to your audience and speak to them about some of the founding principles and the first principles in the founding documents of the United States of America, because you know that's the kind of thing that makes us special. You mentioned the fact that it's difficult to tell from my writing where I am on the political spectrum. And the fact is I've taken the stance that the founding principles and our documents that our shared heritage, they're not liberal, they're not Democrat, they're not conservative, they're not Republican. The fact is they're American, and they're the thing that should be binding us, and we should have more in common than we do that tears us apart.
I think that's very well said, but I find that as we grow in our lives, we go farther and farther from understanding the documents or even trying to understand them. And in my experience, and I talk to a lot of attorneys, a lot of senators, representatives. We've had Senator Lieberman on this show, Senator Murphy on this show. It just seems that after either law school or high school or college, no one goes back and looks at it. And when anybody seems to talk about the Constitution these days, it seems to be in such a myopic view without having a full understanding of the document. And one of the things that I like that you wrote is when you're looking at these documents, you have to take into context the history, the philosophy, and the mechanical parts of the institution. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit more? Because people try to view the document in a vacuum, and I don't think that that's how the documents were intended.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. You know, it's very, very nice when you hear about people that say they carry a copy of the Constitution in their pocket, and that's nice. That's dedication. But the Constitution itself is kind of a mechanical description of the way the government should run. In constitutional soundbites, of course, we've got. We'll talk about that a little bit. We've got what amounts to 150 questions and answers about the founding documents. That includes the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And within those 150 frequently asked questions, or at least frequently asked by me, there's 140 references to the Declaration of Independence. You don't understand the Constitution if you don't understand the Declaration. The Declaration of Independence is the inspiration, and the Constitution is the execution. And I think that if people just focus on the Constitution without understanding the Declaration, they, you know, it's one thing. It's certainly one thing to know how many congressmen we're supposed to have and how many years a president serves and those kinds of things, but you don't really understand the purpose of all of that if you don't get a feel for the Declaration of Independence. The Bill of Rights, about 70-some-odd% of it is really devoted to things related to criminal procedure, because when the government's going to exercise its harshest power, that is to take somebody's life, liberty, or property, that's what the founders wanted, to have the most controls over the government in exercising that. And you'll find that in the complaints against King George that are expressed in the Declaration of Independence, those are the things that you find built into the Bill of Rights. So that's a singular large example of, you can't even understand the Bill of Rights if you don't understand the Declaration of Independence.
And the Declaration was written as a legal writ, because Jefferson was an attorney. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Thomas Jefferson was an attorney, and he wrote it. Strangely enough, you know, of course, lawyers are trained in certain ways, and one of the ways we're trained is to not reinvent the wheel, and to follow formats. You know, we have a form book for everything, for a deed, for a will, for a power of attorney, for just about anything you can imagine. You know, these days, of course, it's on discs, but even in Jefferson's day, they had those things listed in a big book. And if you took a criminal complaint, which in the forefront says who's involved, Then it lays out what the law is. Then it lays out what the conduct is, and then it lays out what the result should be, or the punishment should be because of the conduct. You'll find the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson opened up his form book and took out a criminal complaint, and you could just as well call it the United States of America versus King George, as well as the Declaration of Independence. And so you kind of need to get a feel for those kinds of things. And when he went through that all, you know, he went through the whole format and the end result of that, because, of course, up in the front, he stated the law. And the way he stated the law was the principle was the law of nature, and nature's God, which in those six or seven words, he summed up the legitimacy of the United States of America, which is really, really kind of important. And it's really interesting about those seven words, the law of nature and of nature's God, because Jefferson covers the whole gamut by doing that. When you consider the fact that the law of nature is something that is observable, something that you can measure, something you can see. And when he's talking about that, he's talking about human behavior. You know, there's no. It doesn't matter what the government tries to do. A government cannot outlaw the law of gravity in its territory, right? And
ooh, absolutely.
The government can't. Yeah, they can't. It's not that they. It's not that they won't try from time to time, but they just they can't do it. You know, and it doesn't matter how much the government tells you things, they're not going to be able to outlaw the innate desire of every human being to want to be free. And that is where he covers that by saying the law of nature. When he goes of nature's God, there's certainly a huge there was a huge situation, a huge involvement and belief at the time, and there's still an important component to divine inspiration in most Americans' lives these days. But the fact is whether it's from observable facts on the ground, or whether you consider these things that is inalienable rights and the consent of the governed and the right of revolution, whether you consider those things to be innate in human nature, or whether you consider them to be the result of divine inspiration, they come out the same place. So Jefferson's putting together that phrase, and that drives everything else that happens. That drives you know, the unalienable or inalienable rights. Is very interesting. Neither Jefferson nor Ben Franklin could figure out whether they were going to go with inalienable or unalienable. They mean the same thing, but we still have it. So 240 some years later, we still have that issue. We can't figure out what's the difference between inalienable or unalienable. Interesting stuff like that. But the fact is that and inalienable rights and the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these kinds of things, whether they're divine inspiration or not, but they are the foundation for the United States being legitimate. Every legal thing that happens in the rest of the country derives from the Declaration of Independence, even though technically speaking it's not doesn't have the force of law, but it is the force and driving philosophy, and it's the inspiration that ultimately is executed by the Constitution.
So for firefighters deal with contracts all the time. So essentially, while the Federalist Papers could probably be considered the bargaining history of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence is kind of like the beginning of that bargaining history of how we even got there in the first place. Is that a fair statement? And the fact that the reason inalienable means so much to Americans is the fact that, and I think you said it, is that if our rights come from a higher power, then no man or government can take them away. Is that a fair statement?
That's the basic principle, that no higher power, there is no higher power. That power is that the power wherever those rights come from, whether it's from God or from the natural inclinations of human beings, no government has the authority or ability to take them away. They may try, but they certainly don't have any legitimate authority to take them away. And so that's where they derive the rest of the situation with the consent of the governed. And so the Federalist Papers are really about how to execute the ideals of the Declaration. And then, of course, through the bargaining of the ratification process, we wound up with a promise to have. And unlike many politicians these days, the politicians, James Madison among them, that promised that if the Constitution was ratified, they would add a Bill of Rights. They did, in fact, do that. That was one of the first orders of business of the brand new government, was to add the Bill of Rights. And so they kept the promise. There was a tremendous honor among those guys, you know, when they made that promise, because the Federalists had won a huge majority in the first Congress, and there was no legal basis. They didn't have to bargain to have control. They already had the control of the Congress, but they had made the promise that they would add the Bill of Rights to have specific protections, i.e. Life, liberty. Speaking of which, there's one question and one question from Constitutional Soundbites, and I don't mean to put you particularly on the spot, but I will say that only 1 in 1,000 Americans can answer this question. And that is, what are the 5 rights in the First Amendment?
What are the 5 rights in the First Amendment? Freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of association. Hold on. Freedom of public assembly?
The right to peaceable assembly is one of them.
So I only got one?
You got two. You got press. and peaceable assembly.
That's it, huh? So, okay, so then I don't want to take too much of our time, so enlighten us.
We have religion, freedom of religion.
Oh, okay.
Is the second one. Actually, it's the very first one. It goes religion, then it goes speech, freedom of speech. Then it goes freedom of press. Then it goes the right to peaceably assemble. And the last one, the fifth and final right in the First Amendment, is the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And an interesting thing about that is you so often, you know, people, you know, give lip service to the concept that if we neither exercise nor protect our rights, we will lose them. We, in fact, have lost the fifth right in the First Amendment, which is why almost nobody remembers it, because nobody talks about it, because it's gone. It's still there on paper, but you got to figure that the guys that wrote the First Amendment, James Madison did the original draft. But when you're going to put a right with the four all stars, press, speech, religion, assembly, it's going to rank with those, and it was as important when they passed it as any of the rest of them. And the fact is it didn't mean writing emails or sending letters or asking questions at a town hall. There was a tradition, not only a tradition, but it was considered to be a right that you, in fact, could, when you petitioned your legislature, the legislature was duty bound to consider your petition and often give it an up or down vote, or at least to have hearings on it. And in the 1840s and 1850s, Congress was inundated with petitions to abolish slavery. And the democratically controlled Congress in those days got tired and embarrassed on all the petitions to abolish slavery, and they instituted a gag rule doing away with petitions to abolish slavery. And little by little, we lost our right to petition the government for redress of grievances in the fashion that it was established when the First Amendment was written. And that's a cautionary tale, because often people, you know, say that if we don't exercise or we don't protect or we don't defend our rights, we will lose them. Well, we, in fact, have lost one of the rights that's in the First Amendment.
That's remarkable. And we lost it without a constitutional amendment. We just lost it in the practice of the law.
That we lost it just in the practice of the law and by not demanding that we have it. It no longer exists for all practical purposes. I mean, it's there. It's on paper. But in the essence, and by the way, Frank, you mentioned you know, the links on Twitter. They're to my website, which is shestokas.com, and that's shestokas.com. And on the website, there's the story of how we lost the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And that story, and maybe about 200 others in addition to the book, you know, so you can find that story there.
Dave, I think most people don't know that, because even myself, I thought that petition the government meant that kind of that you had your rights to go through the courts. So I didn't realize that the petition the government was a literal thing to petition the government. That's very interesting.
It was a literal thing, and in fact, it was so broad at the time during both the colonial and the early days of the republic that petitions were considered. It was considered the right of even women who couldn't vote, and even slaves, and even minor children had the right to file petitions with the legislature and have them entertained. And in fact, what the vestige is of the right to petition for redress of grievances is the committee system. The committee system that the government that the Congress operates under is left over from the fact that they had committees to entertain the petitions that came in from the citizens. And that's why we still have a committee system. But we don't have the right to go in and demand that the committee entertain the ideas that we have. So that's why
remarkable.
Only 1 in 1,000 Americans can name all 5 rights in the First Amendment. It's
well, I only got 2, so I'm not doing too good. But the couple of them I knew. The press one I knew, and one of the things that I think is going kind of wrong in this country is that I believe that the press is one of the great pillars of our republic or democracy. But the press has gone away from doing their homework just because they've been cut so bad. My father was on the board of directors of a newspaper, and he was in charge of the circulation department. But in the day when I was a kid, if you read a story, they actually wrote and researched the story. Now when you read a story, everybody's quoting other papers. The New York Times said this, Fox News said this, and that investigative part of the papers, because of how, you know, the modern time with the internet and everything, it's actually, I think, does our republic a disservice.
There's no question that the press is not fulfilling the function that it had while I don't know how old you are, Frank, but it certainly is not fulfilling the function that it had while I was growing up. You know, your Woodwards and Bernsteins don't exist. I know both those gentlemen remain alive, but the guys that did that work to really reveal the goings-on in the Nixon administration and utilizing appropriate sources and double and triple checking them before they published anything, that just doesn't happen, which is why it's really, really difficult and why people have lost so much faith in the press. On the other hand, maybe you know, there's an evolution to everything, and the internet and those kinds of situations and personal sites and Twitter and those kinds of things give more people a voice, and although then the duty becomes on the citizen or the individual to kind of sort out and find the sources that they think are appropriate, not necessarily that they agree with, but rather are accurate. You know, I've been doing this particular website on the Constitution and legal issues for about 5-6 years now. Since 2012, this particular iteration, and I've only got about 200 some odd pieces because it takes me a good week, 10 days to make sure that what I put in a given piece is accurate. You know, so you hopefully, you know, regarding different sources, you can find that there's plenty of information out there. It's unfortunate that the press does not have the resources that they once had. On the other hand, maybe we've got a million reporters. The problem is trying to sort through what's true and what's not.
And as you said, it takes time to research this stuff.
Oh, it does. It absolutely does. Before I press publish on a particular piece, I just did one on Trump's immigration orders and the positions that the court took, the two courts of Maryland and Hawaii, that they took on those immigration orders. And it took me, you know, about 5, 6, maybe 7 days to really do what I wanted to do. And that was to be accurate on representing what those judges had to say, be accurate on what the order had to say, and come to the conclusion that the judges had actually become lawless. The judges actually determined that they wanted a state policy. They did not want to follow the law. You know, there's a particular way to judge the constitutionality of a presidential order, and it dates back to the steel seizure cases when Harry Truman tried to take over the steel industry during the Korean War. And there are several tests for the constitutionality of a presidential order. And Donald Trump's orders on immigration met every test for constitutionality. And neither judge in Maryland nor Hawaii mentioned the leading Supreme Court case that defines the test for the constitutionality of presidential orders, because they just wanted to come to a conclusion rather than follow the law. And this is troublesome, and that's one of the problems, of course, with the lack of education that our people have generally on our common heritage, because they're not in a position to judge what a judge does. You know, a judge should be just as transparent, probably more transparent than just about anybody else, and you should be able to judge what a judge does. But if you have not even a smidgen, go ahead.
I think that it and Justice Scalia said this, and Gorsuch repeated it in when he was accepting his nomination to the Supreme Court, was that if you're a judge and you like all of your decisions, you're probably a bad judge. And I think people forget that they're not supposed to be politicians in robes. They have a function set out by the Constitution, and just because they may want it to be something, that's not their role. And why don't you speak to that? Because we see that throughout our country now, is that we're starting to use the courts, or trying to use the courts, as a political tool to circumvent the legislative process, which is not their intended function.
No, it's not their intended function. And the problem with when we use the courts like that, and the courts take these issues out of the public discourse, then you wind up with situations like people still fighting over Roe versus Wade, because what the courts did when they created this right to privacy, and strangely enough, they didn't really create a right to abortion. That's often misstated, because people don't really look at that, and they state policy. But when they do things like that, or more recently, the cases regarding gay marriage, they take that out of the political process. And when they take it out of the political process, they leave tremendous numbers of people frustrated with no outlet and no place to go. The gay marriage situation is certainly a good example of that, because, of course, those the folks that were in favor of such a thing were largely winning the political battle before the court stepped in. Those 20-some-odd states where it had become legal, either legislatively or through state courts, which were doing interpretations of the state constitutions, which is something that's frequently overlooked. So the political battle was being won, and people were coming to grips with that through the political process. And in fact, of course, there's all kinds of other, consequences of the court's decision. That is, situations regarding adoptions and children and inheritance and all the other kinds of things that are attendant to when the state recognizes a particular relationship. That when the court just does it by fiat, that does not give the political process an opportunity to take into account all the consequences of these decisions. And it's really, really unfortunate that folks have determined that sometimes it's appropriate to utilize the courts to reach policy questions when policy questions are not supposed to be decided by the courts. And they're supposed to be decided by the legislative process and the political process. And so that causes more divisiveness than it does unity. Because if you work through the political process, ultimately everybody's had their say. They may not like the outcome, but at least they've had the opportunity to have input. And so it's very dangerous for courts to take a subject out of the discourse by saying there's a constitutional right, when of course the context of the Constitution doesn't provide any right in that regard whatsoever. And so it's unfortunate, but we've asked so many people have asked the courts, and unfortunately too many judges are too anxious to go ahead and impose their own policy considerations on so many subjects, rather than leave it to the legislative process, which is where most stuff belongs. We say, we would talk about the Constitution for a moment. Again, and you talk about the co-equal branches of government. In theory, they're co-equal, but as the way it's written, if you consider there's something to the structure of the Constitution, Article 1, the very first thing in the Constitution describes the United States Congress, its powers, its authority, its duty, terms of office, the eligibility. And it was in Article 1 for a reason. It was in Article 1 because it was supposed to be first among equals, you know, the legislative process was the process by which the will of the people was supposed to be expressed, not through the court system.
Correct. And it's also part of our process that the Congress was actually designed so things didn't happen too quickly. And I think your example, regardless of how you feel about the issue of the gay marriage issue, I think is a perfect example, because it was going through the process and individuals wanted to short circuit it. So even Republicans and conservatives that were saying this is a state issue, they got painted with that broad brush. You're homophobic. For a lot of people, it wasn't even about that. It was about the Constitution and about rights. And individuals in this country now, with everything being so polarized, have trouble differentiating between the two different things.
Well, they differentiate between who's supposed to make moral decisions and who's supposed to make legal decisions. You know, there's a morality that's expressed in the legislative decision, and the courts are just supposed to, once it becomes law, the courts are just supposed to apply it. It's really, you know what? Everybody makes it much more complex than it is.
That is true. That is true. One question I have for you is, and this has to do with the courts, but again, it's one of our branches. Do you know the background of the dissent? Is that an American thing? Did that start in England? Because we have a ruling from the court, but judges still write a dissent. Now, I think sometimes the dissents are more interesting than the actual ruling. But what is the historical significance of writing a dissent? And can you kind of, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's a question that I've always had.
I'll tell you what, I just did a review on my site of a book called The Tyrannical Rule of the United States Supreme Court, written by a fellow by the name of Don Brockett. Don was a prosecutor in Spokane, Washington for about 33 years, head of the office for about 24 years, won 6 elections out there. And his book is really based upon reading the dissents. And it's a great book about that describes how the dissents often indicate where the majority went wrong and how, from time to time, things that were originally dissent ultimately become the law, because over time, of course, the nature of the court changes and judges are persuaded by the philosophy that's built into the dissents. Now, I in terms of your question and the historical development of the filing of dissents, I don't have a lot of information on that. I do know from reading some cases in the 16th and 1700s, there was occasionally somebody would do a dissent on in the English cases where English common law was being developed. But it was a rare animal. And for the first, 15, 20 years, for an extended period of time, during the original conduct of the United States Supreme Court, there wasn't even single opinions issued. It was just the opinion of the court. For a long time, when the U.S. Supreme Court got started, so dissent as a important element of our jurisprudence is probably really really developed in the last maybe 100, 150 years. It was not an original tradition, but it has become one, and it's made some contributions. There's been periods of time where people dissented from things, and ultimately the dissent would win later on over newer justices that said, you know, the guy that was dissenting was really, really right on this issue, as opposed to where the court was at. So it's a healthy thing, but I would recommend the Tyrannical Rule of the United States Supreme Court. There's an article, again, on my website about that. It's a great, great book. Don's a great guy. He just turned 80 this year, and he wrote his first book last year. So he's a
tremendous.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and maybe sometime you probably would like to talk to Don about some of this, you know. So, but you mentioned at the very beginning oaths and firefighters. You know, you do know, of course, you guys do take oaths of office. It's interesting to note that oath is actually required by the Constitution. I don't know if you guys cover those kinds of things in your training and background. I'm sure you have some legal training as part of your activities, but I don't know if they tell you that the oath of office is actually traced to the Constitution, Article 6, Clause number 3, and it says all executives and judicial officers of the several states shall be bound by an oath or affirmation to support the Constitution. And in fact, firefighters are in fact part of the executive branch of government, because they're executing within their defined area. They're executing the law, and so the oath of office is required by the Constitution itself. And so often, it's another thing that I have to live with from time to time when I talk about these things. People say that it's a old document that doesn't have any effect on us today, and it was written by a bunch of rich old white guys, and all those other kinds of things to try and diminish the value of the Constitution. But in fact, stuff like, well, you're in Connecticut, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The Constitution State. That's exactly right. And do you know why that's another aside? You know why you're the Constitution State?
I believe that Connecticut was the first. I think it was called Fundamental Orders or something to that extent. But
it was the first fundamental Constitution. Exactly right. In the history of the world,
I feel a little better now. My First Amendment blunder.
You're absolutely right. And the first written Constitution in the history of the world came from Connecticut. Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. And it bound three towns together in kind of a federal system that ultimately would find its way to the United States Constitution. It was the things that they set up with the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. But at any rate, of course, you're in Connecticut, and you're in that area where you can probably drive 20, 25 minutes, and you're in a different state than you were before. You know, you're surrounded. That's not necessarily the case out west here, but the fact is why is your driver's license in Connecticut that you get from Connecticut good in New York?
That's something that I was reading in your book, and I got a question for you. So the states have to recognize, because it's another document from another state and we're the United States. So then why isn't that the case with a gun permit? Which a driver's license is a privilege.
There's something called the full faith and credit clause, and there's something also that, of course, the format of the book has, you know, answers all these questions in 90 to 120 words. There's also something that allows for the states to enter compacts between themselves with the consent of Congress, but it is the combination of the compact and the combination of the full faith and credit clause. However, interestingly enough, there's been a judicial exception which has got to do with the tyrannical rule of the United States Supreme Court to the full faith and credit clause, and that is if a particular policy of one state is what they call repugnant to the public policy of another state, there's limits on the full faith and credit clause. And which was going to be a huge issue, or a potentially large issue regarding the development of the gay marriage situation, but the states would have worked it out, you know, whether or not a state was going to honor the same sex marriage of a state that passed it relative to a state that didn't recognize it. I think over time they probably would have wound up following the full faith and credit clause, but that's all hypothetical because the Supreme Court didn't let us work it through. But in any event, you know, that's the Constitution's at work in our daily lives and things like driver's licenses and the oath of office for firefighters that people don't even know that this traces to the Constitution. You know, it's why you can buy Florida oranges without having to pay a Florida export tax on them. Which was the true meaning of the Interstate Commerce Clause. And so it's worthwhile knowing, because it is something that we share as Americans. So it's not a dead document. And so, you know,
now something that's coming up in
important stuff.
Well, what do you call it? But it is kind of a dead document as well. I mean, it can be changed, but isn't it, in a sense, a dead document, kind of like a contract? Like a contract can be changed, but the contract is the contract. So isn't the Constitution a dead document?
Oh, okay. Well, there's different senses of dead, I suppose.
Fair enough.
Yeah, different senses of dead. But the fact is the Constitution, should it be? Frozen in time to the intent of the people that drafted it and the people that participated in the ratification process? Absolutely. It should be frozen in time to the intent of that group of individuals with the 27 amendments that we have in fact enacted since that time, 10 of which were the Bill of Rights, 17 others since there, which brings me to a different subject. I hope you don't mind if we're a little wide-ranging as things come up.
No, this is great.
But
I'm learning stuff. This is great.
We'll go to the 18th Amendment for just a moment. The 18th Amendment, of course, was prohibition. And the 18th Amendment outlawed alcohol nationally. And, of course, the 18th Amendment was an utter failure in outlawing alcohol. All the 18th Amendment did give us was a national police force and organized crime. It didn't give us anything good. And the reason why the 18th Amendment didn't work was it was the only amendment to the Constitution to restrict the people's liberty. It was the only amendment that was passed contrary to natural law and the law of nature's God. And that's why the 18th Amendment was there. That's a demonstration of what Jefferson was talking about, that no matter what the government, there's natural inherent limits on what the government can do. And the 18th Amendment demonstrated that and gave, and we're still living with the terrible aftermath these days, because it set in motion organized crime. And, of course, there was no national police force. There was no significant thing like the FBI before Prohibition. There was a small investigative force and a small protective force that had been developed around taking care of the president, with about 20-some agents in the early 1900s. But they farmed out some law enforcement activities to some private detectives, Pinkerton among them. But the first time that there was a huge intrusive national police force was the result of the 18th Amendment. And of course, once government establishes something, all it does is get bigger and more intrusive. And so we wound up with the 21st Amendment that repealed the 18th, but it was a demonstration of the principles that Jefferson, it was when the country went away from the principles that Jefferson laid out in the Declaration of Independence, that's when it was, when you wound up with such a huge failure of policy. So
basically the Constitution is a balance between power and liberty. And when the Constitution talks about individuals, it talks about rights. And when it talks about powers, it's talking about the federal state governments. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly correct. As you referenced Madison, and Madison's statement on that is that every word in the Constitution decides a question of power versus liberty. You're exactly right.
I gotta put out there how naive I am, because I consider myself a lifelong student, but because Madison is the father of the Constitution, most Americans think that he wrote it. I always knew that it was Governor Morrison, but I thought that was his title, and I didn't realize that that was his name until reading constitutional soundbites. I swear to God, because I think I've even asked a couple people, where was he the governor of? So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
I think that most
Governor
Americans
Morris,
would think that.
Yeah, yeah, Governor Morris ultimately was the – and you can quote Madison on that. Well, Governor Morris was ultimately the penman of the Constitution. There was about when they got through with the work of the convention, they had like 28 articles and Lord knows how many different kinds of amendments. And they formed a committee on style, and the committee on style consisted of Madison, Hamilton, Governor Morris, and at the moment, I'm sorry, there's two other guys whose names escaped me. But they ultimately handed the task over to Morris, and Morris was the one that gave us the structure and the wording that turned into the Constitution that we know with the seven articles. And
it was King and Johnson.
Pardon me?
It was William Johnson, and I'm going to mispronounce his name. It was Rufus King, because I got your book right in front of me.
Okay. All right. Yeah, Rufus.
One thing that I want to get to is that our republic is set up with the separation of powers. So you have the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. And most people don't realize that. Also, having the state and local governments play into that. But if you talk to most Americans, they still believe to this day that we have a democracy, which we don't. And you quoted, I think you might have quoted in your book, Madison, which I thought was just a great quote that firefighters could definitely relate to out there, where he said something along the lines, a democracy would be the equivalent of having two wolves and a lamb take a vote on what to have for dinner. So essentially, the founders didn't want to have a true democracy because the rights of minorities, not the minorities in the sense of the word that we consider minorities today, but minority opinion would be the lamb. Can you expand upon that?
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And actually that quote is belongs to Ben Franklin. Which is one of the reasons why Ben's on the cover of the book with headphones. I used to do a radio show called Constitutionally Speaking. We did promos for the show. And the promos would be a minute of constitutionally speaking. I collected those promos, and then I added to them and organized them, and that was the result, was Constitutional Soundbites. And inside the book, though Ben Franklin's on the cover, because he would have been one of the world's great talk show hosts, because he comes up with things like, what's the definition of democracy? Well, democracy would be like two wolves and a lamb taking a vote on what to have for dinner. And so you know that, and you're exactly right. What the guys created was a republic, and a republic is a representative democracy. And the idea behind the republic with a written constitution was to, in fact, prevent what they call the tyranny of the majority. Because anytime there would be 50% plus one, of the citizenship, that's what a pure and true democracy is, then they could decide that the other 49.99% don't have any rights or are going to become slaves, or they could lock them up and throw away the key. They could do anything. And the idea was that pure democracy is extraordinarily dangerous because it has the tremendous passions of the moment, passions of what one would consider a transient majority, maybe at a particular given point in time, people, there's a 50% plus one for a terrible, terrible idea. And so the idea was to allow things to percolate. When people talk about, Congress not doing anything, the fact is Congress was not designed to work swiftly.
Congress was designed, hopefully, in the end, to work wisely. And so that's why, in fact, that's why we have two houses of Congress, one being the one that's elected every 2 years and should be most responsive to the people, the House of Representatives, and one to temper the passions of the moment with the longer terms and only turning over one third at any given election, the United States Senate. And so that's the idea, is that Congress is supposed to work slowly so that it doesn't come up with terrible ideas and make terrible laws. It's supposed to work not quickly, but wisely. And so democracy is really, really dangerous. You know, it's if, you know, you got a half a dozen people, you got five people in a bike club and three of them decide that they want to have everybody's bikes. Well, then 3-2, they win, and they win everybody's bikes. You know, so it's a dangerous thing. And so we are not a democracy. We weren't intended to be a democracy. And the idea, as you said, was to protect the rights of, not as people talk about, ethnic or demographic minorities, but rather political or minorities, people that have a different approach or a different way of thinking. There's to see to it that they always have an opportunity to be heard, and that their rights are not going to be trampled on, and that their rights will be considered in the ultimate policy that the government executes. And so it was really, really, yeah, it was very, very important to those guys. That's certainly one of the messages that you find in constitutional soundbites. You'll find out where some of these ideas came from. You know, they worked on the Constitution for 5 months in the summer of 1787, but Madison worked for maybe 6-8 months, close to a year before the convention, studying all the kinds of governments that had been in existence throughout human history. And you can trace back a lot of the ideas that they discussed to almost 1,800 years. They had the benefit of most of the human experience at organizing governments when they sat down to do the Constitution. So it wasn't something that was just born out of somebody's mind at that moment in time. They studied and worked hard and tried to not make the same mistakes that other governments had made over the history of humanity.
One of the things that I want to go back to, and you talked about that, you know, some people dismiss the Constitution because they claim it was written by a bunch of rich white guys, is the 14th Amendment. And I truly believe that the 14th Amendment realized the promise of the Declaration of Independence and the sacrifice of the Civil War. But when looking back today, if you talk to a lot of people, they think everybody agreed on everything back in the day. That is definitely not the case. It was a complete compromise. I try to compare it to a contract. One quote that I found, that I think tonight's the quote of false, but one quote that I found, and it was in Time magazine on Thomas Jefferson, and I'd never seen it anywhere else, which helped sum it up, was when they were trying to get the Constitution approved, Jefferson was quoted, and again, I got this from Time magazine, he was quoted as the context was they were trying to get it passed, and he said, "The issue of slavery was the equivalent of holding a wolf by its ears. You couldn't safely hold it, and you couldn't safely let it go." So my understanding of it, and please enlighten me, was that the slavery part of the Constitution was necessary to have a Constitution because it was a compromise. And the one thing where I agree with Charles Krauthammer, which is, separates us away from all other countries, is that when we make mistakes, we tend to correct them. And so I don't think that people should look at the document and say, "Oh, well, it's a racist document," because I've heard that said numerous times throughout my career. So if you can expound upon that, I would appreciate it.
Here's a quick – we talked about Governor Morris, and the writing of the Constitution. If you will notice, there is never in the document the term slavery. Morris and the committee and ultimately the convention went out of their way, particularly Morris, went out of his way to make sure that slavery was not constitutionalized. Slavery, they went out of their way to make sure that slavery was not something that you would have to amend the Constitution to get rid of. I think that's something that people miss. When you say that it was a racist document, I would refer anybody to the speeches and talks of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass being the freed slave who became one of the leading abolitionists leading up to the Civil War, and was in fact the first black guest of a president, President Lincoln, at the White House. And Frederick Douglass is puts together the best argument to see to it that to understand how the document set in motion the abolition of slavery, rather than constitutionalizing and preserving slavery. That was the way. It was, in fact, a compromise. They weren't in a position to abolish it. But if you think about a couple of things, there's a provision there that bans the international slave trade beginning in 1800, 11 years after the Constitution's adoption. I take that back. It allowed the Congress to ban international slave trade beginning in 1800 after the adoption of the Constitution. And in fact, Congress, as soon as constitutionally able to do so, did in fact ban the international slave trade. There's some things Douglass argues that the two-thirds compromise, the consideration of people held to servitude, considered to be only two-thirds of a person for purposes of representation. He said that obviously indicates that they did not want to consider these individuals property. It was very, very difficult. And strangely enough, that was a matter that was left over from the compromise that was in the Articles of Confederation. And so they, given the tenor of the times, it would not have there would have not been a constitution if the Constitution gone on to outlaw slavery. On the other hand, the Constitution went out of its way to not mention the term and see to it that the institution of slavery was not constitutionalized, allowing for its abolition, which is a completely different view. Jefferson was correct, but you have to see to it, you have to understand that for 10,000 years, for all of human history, before the Declaration of Independence, before the Constitution, before the Bill of Rights, in all the rest of the world, the whole entire world was ruled by dictators and kings and czars and sultans, and there had been slaves throughout all of human history, white, black, whatever color, Mongols, Asians. Conquering armies would take the conquered in as slaves, right? So when these folks put together these ideals and principles, they set in motion the end of what had been 10,000 years of human history. And considering that we're only 200 and some odd years removed from what they set in motion and from the principles that Dr. King relied upon in his speeches and his presentations, and that Frederick Douglass relied upon, and the document created the atmosphere that would lead not to only the abolition of slavery in this country, but would set the trend to where slavery became unacceptable throughout the world.
And that's a pretty remarkable feat after 10,000 years of human history.
Yeah, I would say. Change 10,000 years of human history in a couple of hundred years. Are we by any means close? Are we by any means close to perfect? No, but would we be worse off had this group of amazing individuals not put forward these principles by which we are organized? Yeah, we would be much worse off.
Without a doubt. And we are at the witching hour, so before I have you plug your website and book again so everybody can find out how to get to your website. I think you just ended on a perfect note where you said more perfect. Can you explain that term? Because that's something that I learned the history of in reading your book, which I thought was interesting.
Well, and more perfect was, of course, you find that in the preamble to the Constitution, in order to form a more perfect union. And people these days in the 21st century, perfect means, of course, without fault or without sin. But the only individual anybody considers to be a perfect human being, perhaps, might be Jesus Christ. And so perfect, and you can't, and more perfect seems to be kind of a oxymoron. But the fact is perfect in the 18th century was utilized in the sense that it would derive from the Latin perficere, and that meant simply to complete. And what the problem was with the Articles of Confederation was that the Articles of Confederation were an incomplete union. And so when they said, when Morris said in the preamble, a more perfect union, he meant a more complete union than existed under the Articles of Confederation. And so and that's a good example, Frank, of how people need to have a feel for what the language meant in the 18th century to understand it in 21st century terms.
And it's amazing. Just a little education helps. Dave, I really want to thank you for coming on the show. If you could give everybody your website name again, your Twitter handle, and the name of the book again, and then we'll end the show for tonight. And thanks for being a great guest. I picked up a lot, and I know our listeners did as well. I really appreciate you coming on. If you could give us your website, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. It's my last name, Shestokas, Shestokas.com. There's a lot more to read there, but the book will give you Constitutional Soundbites is available on Amazon, both in print and Kindle. And my Twitter handle is my last name, at Shestokas, Shestokas. And thanks so much for having me, Frank, and I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Anytime, Dave. Thanks very much. For all our listeners, we're only a month away from FDIC. I hope to see everybody in Indianapolis. If you haven't had an opportunity to go to FDIC, the Fire Department Instructors Conference, we'd really love to have you. There's phenomenal classes out there, over 35,000 firefighters from around the English-speaking world and now the Spanish-speaking world, attend FDIC. Please come out and check out my class. This year I'll be teaching Making the Grab, Applying Science While Still Being an Aggressive Company. Dave, thank you so much for coming on, and that's it for tonight for Politics and Tactics.